At this event, we expect to identify 150 youth signed to our one-year full internship and scholarships program.
Wow.
We're working with the City Auditor's Department of Portland, several nonprofits, education facilities, private government entities, you name it, we've got it.
Well, this is something that's going to be truly beneficial for the community and young people. I'm seeing there's interfaith, there's an interfaith alliance, there's multi-generational leadership, and there's an appeal to invite young people from the area, from all over the area, to engage with leaders in the community around questions of survival, opportunity, stability, success, career paths, and so forth. So I want to say thank you. Kabu was
proud. One of the things I'd like to add is with this event, youth are given exclusive access to these leaders and teachers of 21st century leadership here in the United States and specifically Oregon. So the opportunities are exponential.
Good. And I'm hoping that we're going to help get the word out to people in the area by having you on. And I will see you this weekend. If not, we'll talk a little bit more beforehand. I want to thank you for coming on. Anissa Islam Farkhan, peace. And did you have anything else you wanted to say before we conclude?
Shout out to Cakes by Katie.
Okay. Well, thank you. Have a good day, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. I wanted to give a special shout out to Brother Naeem Jue Ali of Cheney University outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, for providing security for this weekend's coming events.
And I would like to let you know that Locus Focus is off today, and we are about to hear an episode of Radio EcoShock with Dr. Alan Hastings and Dr. David Orr.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
Well, deadly flooding in Rio de Janeiro has raised questions about whether the city is equipped to host the 2016 Olympics. The floods triggered mudslides that killed at least 95 people. More than 1,400 others were chased from their homes. The flooding caused a power outage in the neighborhood where almost half the
Melbourne's main streets became raging torrents as the city was drenched by nearly 30 millimeters in less than 60 minutes. The pounding of giant hailstones cracked like gunfire.
Back here at home tonight, an update on the historic flooding that left parts of southern New England underwater this past week.
Global warming? From Rhode Island to Rio to Queensland, 100-year floods, 200-year floods, all-time record rains happening all over the world. And as TV tells it, everyone is just a freak storm or the power of El Nino. America's oldest freestanding stone bridge was just washed away last week, after 300 years. The state of Rhode Island went underwater. The whole New England coast was pounded with days of record rains. When it stopped, the weather jerked into sudden summer heat. It's all part of the unknown climate. Who would have guessed? Maybe Radio EcoShock listeners 3 years ago, as I interviewed scientist Noah Diffenbaugh about extreme rainfall events.
And in 2005, your team released one of the most detailed climate model predictions for North America. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we found that elevated greenhouse gas concentrations substantially increase the frequency of extreme precipitation events and also the contribution of those events to the total annual precipitation. So not only do the heaviest events become more frequent as greenhouse gas concentrations rise, but they also represent a larger fraction of the total precipitation that comes during the year.
But you won't hear any of that from TV weather reporters. George Mason University's Center for Climate Change Communication released a study of weathercasters. Sure, they talk about climate change to say over and over again it isn't happening. 63% of weather people told the university that natural causes are behind any warming. Another 27% say warming isn't happening at all. It's a big scam. Only the oil men rank higher for skepticism.
Our team coverage of the flooding that's crippling parts of the state continues. A landmark has been lost in Lisbon. An historic bridge believed to be the oldest of its kind in the country was destroyed during that severe weather yesterday.
So my message, first of all, to the public out there is, frankly, from a flooding standpoint, the worst is still ahead of us.
Do I hear global warming? And who are these doubters with a massive audience? Just half of them have a degree in meteorology. A handsome or pretty face is the main job qualification. We'd have to dig deep to find a single one with scientific training in climate science. In fact, these would-be experts hardly get the next day's weather right, much less the expectations for the next decade. And their corporate employers, running all those oil and car ads, don't mind a bit if the big silence about global warming turns into a smear. Sooner or later, humans standing in the latest floodwaters or fire are going to accept the big change has come, and they are not going to remember the TV liars kindly.
Can it be blamed on El Nino, which seems to take the rap for everything lately?
El Nino really kind of is the bottom line culprit here, because that's the one that's responsible for helping that storm track come again and again and again, bringing storms across the south, up through the mid-Atlantic, and into the northeast.
Can anybody say global warming? Too bad ABC News didn't read the report from the University of New Hampshire. It's called Trends in Extreme Precipitation Events for the Northeastern United States, 1948 to 2007. They found that these heavy rainfall events have doubled recently. But hey, who needs the facts? The report says that heavy flooding rains is the new normal for the Northeast, and that fits in with the, quote, projections of climate change associated with global warming, end quote. Scientists like Susan Solomon have been warning the other half of climate change is all about precipitation. The subtropics, including much of the southern United States, the Mediterranean, North Africa, the Middle East, and most of Australia, will go into a prolonged and severe drought. But the hotter world soaks up more water vapor, and the hotter ocean adds both moisture and energy to the clouds. Places where rain likes to fall are going to be drenched beyond the capacity of our older stormwater systems. Expect insurance companies to withdraw flood insurance from some northern states. It isn't just global warming, it's global wetting. Get used to it, no matter what the flunkies on TV say to deflect the truth.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio at ecoshock.org. That's radio at ecoshock.org.
In the spring of 2010, the east coast of the United States was nearly drowned in an extreme precipitation event. Right afterwards, eastern Canada went way above any temperature records, hitting summer beach weather, the 80s, 25 degrees centigrade, in the first week of April. Still, hardly a single network weather person mentioned climate change. Our next guest says humans are very close to climate collapse. David W. Orr is a distinguished professor of environmental studies and politics at Oberlin College in Ohio. He's been a pioneer in greening higher education. He advises many leaders and foundations. His latest book is Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse. Dr. Orr, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
David, what does it mean that people don't believe in climate disruption, even as floods and storms and heat waves surround them?
Well, climate change is somebody once called it, the perfect problem. And it is complicated. The science is difficult to master. And we live in a country where 40% or some such number don't believe in evolution, which is well-established science. So I think it's a complicated thing. It is also, in many people's minds, threatens to disrupt the American way of life and make living harder and so forth. So it's an easy thing to deny. And then the time horizon, the big changes ahead are years or decades into the future, and so it's easy enough to procrastinate. So it hits us really where we're weakest. And so the deniers are, and here in Oberlin today, it's a lovely spring day. It's in the mid-70s, and the sun is shining. And so it's easy enough, I think, to simply dismiss the whole thing if you're so inclined.
And it's been the same in Australia. There's been a wild revival of climate denial there while they export even more coal. And that's after a 10-year drought wiped out their wheat exports and inferno bushfires killed hundreds. What makes you think humans can wake up and react in time?
Well, a good bit of the denial is, if you use the attorney's rule of thumb of follow the money, and you find behind the people with big megaphones and access to the airwaves on television and radio and so forth, and a written press, you find a good bit of coal and oil money paying for the denial. There's not a mystery here. They've put a lot of effort into this in the United States and Australia and Europe and so forth, and there isn't any particular mystery to why denial is flourishing. And then it requires the media doesn't help us much in the United States because for example, in the spring from last year on, it was a little bit cooler in the northeast part of the United States where I live. But other parts of the world were going through weather extremes. And so the fact of the matter is the science on one side coincides rather well with the anecdotal evidence that you describe on the other side. It's very consistent with it. And yet the media doesn't much report that. And so you have these odd things of James Imhoff, a senator from Oklahoma, building igloos on the Capitol grounds to mock Al Gore, while in fact the temperatures at the North Pole were running considerably warmer than they normally would. Pressure differential had pushed a lot of cold air south. But that in itself doesn't mean anything. 2009 was the second hottest year on record in the past decade, was the hottest decade ever recorded. But the media doesn't help us. It gives us little snapshots of opinions, but it doesn't consistently cover the entire planet. And so it's fertile ground for deniers to simply turn their back on the scientific evidence.
Okay, we jumped right into the deep end there. Let's back up a bit to understand your path into the book. Many of our listeners are college students, and that is where your personal green revolution began, it seems to me. Can you tell us a little bit about your efforts at Oberlin College?
Well, let me say two things. One is, beginning in the middle 1990s, we set out to create a model of a green building powered entirely by sunlight that emitted no waste product, water or otherwise. And that's now that project was completed about 10 years ago. That's the Adam Joseph Lewis Center. It's still, I think, the only entirely solar-powered, zero-discharge building on a U.S. college campus. And that's been a terrific laboratory for the study of sustainability. What we did essentially was to downsize problems of energy and landscape and water into a single manageable acre and a quarter site. Second thing I'd say is that's the template now for a much bigger project, 20 times the scale, to get the college and the city of Oberlin to carbon neutrality. We're one of 18 global projects selected by the Clinton Climate Initiative and designated as carbon positive projects. And we're working to establish a large green belt around the city and rebuild a good bit of the downtown and do the whole thing also, as we did with the Lewis Center, as an educational venture, but in this case involving both college students and high school kids, as well as students from two-year colleges and the local vocational school. So those are two things underway. There's actually a good bit of activity at Oberlin. It's a terrifically fertile place, and the students here are wonderfully ingenious and very committed to environmental quality. And so this is a good place, and there's a whole lot of things happening.
Last week on Radio EcoShock, we ran a special program on super low-energy construction techniques. There was passive house and net zero projects. How important is building design in helping to prevent more damaging climate disruption?
Well, buildings are said to be responsible for about 40% of the U.S. carbon footprint. So buildings are a huge part of the future prospect here. If we're supposed to build more than in the next 50 years than we built in the past 5,000. And if we do that carelessly and badly, effectively the ball game's over. I mean, climate, we wouldn't survive the results of powering those buildings. On the other side of it, the building revolution that's sponsored by people at the U.S. Green Building Council and the Living Building Challenge and American Institute of Architects and pioneered by people like Bob Birkenbeil, the architect, and Ed Masria and Bill McDonough and lots of other folks, there's a revolution in design. We know how to make buildings effectively powered by sunshine and make them terrific buildings that work very well for occupants as well as financially for the people that pay the bills. So the revolution in design has really already happened. What we need now is to extend that so that building environmentally responsibly becomes the default setting. It's just the normal way that we build instead of the exceptional way we build. And the U.S. Green Building Council, Rick Fedrizian, Scott Horst, and all the people that work at the USGBC have done a terrific job at making this part of the environmental landscape. It's one of the great success stories of the environmental movement.
David Orr, you were also part of a team of people who helped prepare a climate action plan for President Obama. Can you tell us a little about that?
Well, a group of us met back in 2007 or thereabouts as part of the President's Council on Sustainable Development that had flourished in the Clinton years and had gone dormant in the George Bush years. And one of the ideas that came out of that meeting, 2007, was an idea of developing an action plan for the next U.S. administration, be it Democrat or Republican, that would focus on the first 100 days of the administration in the belief that there was no time to waste and that climate and energy policy, which are flip sides of the same coin, was kind of a linchpin of every other issue, whether it be foreign policy or economic or environmental or whatever else. But if you got that right, you'd get lots of other things right. Bill Becker, who had worked previously for the U.S. Department of Energy for a number of years and a terrific administrator, was the executive director for the project. We met with most of the campaign teams and candidates, including the transition teams for both McCain and Obama. And then after the election, met with the Obama transition group and passed on the plan. Obviously, the first 100 days of the Obama administration has come and gone. They did a number of things that we and other groups and organizations recommended, but it was not the highest priority for them. Healthcare became the highest priority, and that the rest, as they say, is history. That doesn't mean the issue is over by any stretch of the imagination. There is movement in Congress and in the administration to press ahead on climate issues. Last week, the administration announced final rules for the auto efficiency, and so there's movement across the board, but we were focused primarily on the first 100 days. Bill Becker is heading up a second effort, PCAP Part 2, to focus on what's happened since the first year and where do we go from here on out.
Okay, well, I want to switch a little bit here. Gaia theorist James Lovelock has just given another disturbing interview to the BBC in London. Lovelock claims it's too late. We shouldn't waste our money on things like wind energy, but we should spend it all on adapting to the inevitable climate shift. How do you answer that?
Well, James Lovelock is certainly one of the great scientists of our time, arguably the best independent scientist in the world. And so you have to weigh his words carefully. And he's got a great batting average. He's been right about a lot of things in the past. From my perspective, I'd say two things. One is, I don't believe that it can be said authoritatively that it is, in fact, too late. The title of my book captures what I believe to be true, and which is to say, we are going down to the wire. We're getting close to points of no return, but we're not there yet. And so personally, I'm not willing to say that it's too late. The second comment I'd make is that adaptation to what? Do we adapt to 392 parts per million CO2, which is where we are now, or to 400 or 450 or 500 or whatever the future levels could go to? And so adaptation to me seems rather like getting a mop and mopping up water in your bathroom instead of turning the faucet off in your overflowing bathtub. The smart thing to do, it seems to me, would be to put all of your efforts that you can into lowering carbon emissions, improving energy efficiency, making the transition to a renewable energy world, instead of trying to clean up the mess or trying to adapt to what is clearly a moving target, a moving and worsening target. So the first priority, in my judgment, is urgently to, with really wartime urgency, for all the reasons Jim Lovelock says, to lowering carbon emissions and getting them back to levels. Bill McKibben has made quite an organization out of 350 as the target goal. But in fact, we have to probably go eventually, and sooner than later, back below 300 parts per million, closer to the pre-industrial level of 280 parts per million, with what has got to be seen as kind of wartime urgency.
Another worry proposed by Lovelock is that climate change may not develop as a steady rise in either temperature or sea levels. It might happen as sudden jumps and reversals. He says previous climate records show a long-term heating can include intervals, perhaps even decades or more, of some slight cooling as well. Given all the global cooling nonsense from last winter's snowfall in the U.S., do you think climate action plans can survive unsteady weather?
Well, that's a good question. I think what's needed is rather extraordinary leadership at all levels of society, including the media. And I think people, for example, at News Corp that keep folks like Glenn Beck on the radio or on the airwaves in prime time and make sure Rush Limbaugh makes his $400 million contract, do a real disservice, because in the middle of the biggest crisis humankind's ever faced, there are people who serve to confuse, muddy the water, befuddle people, who don't have the time to study the climate issue as a science. And if it's a crime to yell fire in a crowded theater that is not burning, it's a much more serious crime, I think, to prevent people from yelling fire in a theater that is burning. And so I think there has to be a really quite extraordinary level of leadership, starting with the president and working through corporate heads, including corporations that are selling, you know, the vendors of fossil fuels. They clearly know that something is wrong. They can study the scientific record much the same way that you and I can. But the parallel case, it appears to me, to be is the kind of the cigarette case, where executives knew that they were selling an addictive, a harmful substance, and yet went on for years denying it. And the same is certainly true now. The scientific consensus around human impacts on climate is overwhelming. So I think it's going to take an extraordinary level of leadership to turn this around.
I raised Lovelock's worries about the irregular progression of climate change partly because of another paper almost unknown to the general public. A theoretical ecologist at the University of California, Davis, named Alan Hastings, says that climate tipping points may not be predictable at all. According to his work, there may be no signals or warnings before a radical shift. For example, temperatures could just go up rather suddenly and stay there. Do you think that could happen?
Well, I really don't know, and I've not read Alan Hastings' paper, but I think it underscores a bigger issue that years ago a climate scientist said that climate is like an angry beast and we're poking it with sticks. And the record apparently does show that climate can change suddenly. The scientific evidence appears to be fairly consistent on that, or has become fairly consistent. And that being the case, it's all the more imperative that we create prudent low or zero carbon energy futures with a wartime sense of urgency. There's not a moment to spare here. And if there was only one chance in 100 that Alan Hastings' paper is correct, or one chance in 1,000, think of that level of risk relative to a decision to get into a car and ride in a car, or better yet, put your grandchildren in a car where the risk was a fatal accident was 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000. No rational, loving parent or grandparent would do that. And yet the denialists are in a position of asking us to run those kinds of risks, or much greater risks. Frankly, they're closer to 1 to 1, because you can't entirely prove exactly what will happen. But Alan Hastings' work and Jim Lovelock's work shows, or demonstrates, as many others have, is that this is what's called a nonlinear system, where surprises and nasty surprises are part of the way the system works. It's rather like the old saying about the straw that breaks the camel's back. It's the last final increment that breaks the back. It's the last little change that forces the system across the tipping point. And climate appears to be that kind of system.
Well, getting to your own book, Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse, what do you mean by climate collapse?
Well, I mean the collapse of the system that we've become accustomed to. Human society grew up effectively in the only paradise that we've ever known, which geologists call the Holocene. It's the past roughly 12,000 years in which climate was fairly abnormally benign compared to the rest of global climate history. And that's the era in which we became what we are, human. That's the era in which all of our art and poetry and music and history and civilizations around the planet grew up. That's what made us what we are. And in that era, the level of greenhouse gases, or in this case carbon dioxide, never went above roughly 280 parts per million. Now we're already at 392 parts per million, with consequences that we are only beginning to imagine. And so we're effectively evicting ourselves from this paradise that we call the Holocene. And so the collapse I'm referring to is a self-perpetuating collapse that concerns the entire planet. And for our purposes, it would be effectively permanent. Carbon, I start the book with a quote from the geophysicist at the University of Chicago, David Archer, that basically describes carbon staying in the atmosphere for a long time. And so the changes that we're bringing are going to be with us effectively for a very long time. Bill McKibben has a new book coming out called Earth, spelled E-A-A-R-T-H. And the extra A is an indicator of the fact we've already made the Earth into a different planet. It's not the one that we've known over the ages. This is now a hotter, more capricious world that we've created. Exactly how that plays out, we don't know. So the collapse I'm referring to is essentially the collapse of the carbon, or the climate system that we've known throughout our entire evolution as Homo sapiens.
Well, we're starting to run out of time, and I really recommend that listeners get your book, because there's just so many things that we've missed that we haven't had time to cover. But as we wrap up, what message would you like to leave with our listeners? And I'm hoping you'll give us kind of a two-part answer. Your comments for those old enough to remember a stable climate, and then maybe something for college students who are growing up in this time of climate disruption.
Well, the book ends where I'd like to end the interview, and that is on the message of hope. And hope is not the same as optimism. Optimism means that you're going to win the game and you don't have to do anything. And on the other end of the extreme, it's a caution. Don't go into despair that we've changed things and it's late in the ball game. But neither optimism nor despair require you to do anything. It's only in hope that change or to act becomes an imperative. If you're hopeful, you have to do something. You cannot sit passive. And hope, I define in the book, is a verb with its sleeves rolled up. And so the message really to young and old is get engaged, get active, begin to do things. Help your own communities make the transition to carbon neutrality. If you're a homeowner, do that with your own house. If you're a college student, get engaged with campus environmental groups. Join the Climate Action Plan and get your college to pledge and move toward carbon neutrality. So this is not a time to be passive or despairing and not optimistic. It is a time to be hopeful, but that requires everyone, young and old, all of us, to act and act intelligently and strategically to begin to do the things that lower our carbon footprint dramatically and very quickly.
We've been talking with David W. Orr. He's a green pioneer, teacher, and advisor with Ohio's Oberlin College. His latest book is Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse. Find out more at davidworr.com. David, thank you so much for lending us your valuable time.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. A best of Radio EcoShock replay. When Radio EcoShock returns, we'll do a rare interview with Dr. Alan Hastings. He says nature doesn't play smooth or fit graphs. Tipping points can pop up at any time without warning. Kind of puts the shock in EcoShock. We'll find time to thrash through James Lovelock's latest exotic statements to the BBC and maybe catch up with James Hansen on Australian radio. The rest is unknown. Back shortly.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
There are known knowns. There are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we now know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we do not know we don't know.
The idea of tipping points in nature are now well known. The most feared include a sudden shift in global temperature, a breakup of polar ice fields, or release of frozen methane. But such sudden regime shifts happen in a huge range of natural systems. Fisheries suddenly collapse or a species unexpectedly goes extinct. If we can predict these tipping points, perhaps we can stop some of them or at least reduce the impact. A whole school of scientists have been working on this problem for several decades, since our future may depend on the answers. Recently, a body of work led by Martin Scheffer, Jay Brock, and V. Carpenter tried to analyze these rapid shifts, searching for leading indicators which could help us predict danger points. Our guest, Professor Alan Hastings from the University of California, along with UK co-author D.B. Weisham, suggests, quote, drastic changes can appear in nature without warning. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're going to explore this new and worrying research. The paper published in Ecological Letters is titled Regime Shifts in Ecological Systems Can Occur with No Warning. Dr. Hastings, thank you for joining us.
Thank you as well, and that all sounds fine.
Okay, we got the introduction right. That's good. Good place to start. Well, I know that most of my listeners want to know right now whether we can predict when big systems will react to things like carbon pollution in the atmosphere, but that is jumping to conclusions. I'd like to start with an orderly outline of what your paper does say, beginning with that idea of tipping points. How do we know they exist, and could you give us an example?
So one simple example of a tipping point is changing what was not a desert into something that is a desert. If you look in the historical record, the Sahara did not used to be a desert, and by looking at the historical record, you can see it rather rapidly changed from an area with a fair amount of vegetation to the desert that it is today. And this is one prime example, and others, as you pointed out, are collapse of fisheries, and another one is a changing of a lake from its normal state to a eutrophied state where it's full of algae and other organisms.
Well, Martin Scheffer and others have been saying that we're making progress on our mathematical models and other ways of knowing when these leading indicators will happen. And your paper, if I get it right, doesn't say that that's wrong. It's just that prediction may not work for many complex systems. Is that right?
That's exactly right. There are many systems where you can begin to hope that you could understand a simple shift in regimes. And those are ones where, if you think of a ball at the bottom of a valley, it will sort of slide back and forth. And if one side of the valley starts getting lower and lower and lower, one of the mountains on the side, eventually the ball will start to slosh around more until that it will then find its way out. And this is the picture that Martin Scheffer and others have. And it applies to some systems, but unfortunately, many ecological systems, that picture is too simple a picture of the dynamics. And more complicated dynamics mean that this picture just does not apply, and the ball can sort of jump out in unpredictable ways.
So you created models that included some known stresses and then some random or unknown factors. And what did you find?
Well, we found that two things. One is we started off with a general argument that draws on some old work that physicists had done to say that the picture I just described of essentially a surface of where a ball rolls around is far too simple, and that there are cases where you have the kinds of strong interactions that ecologists would look at, and the ball would just sort of jump out, that there is no smooth surface. And what we did is we put in the kinds of interactions of strong density dependent, strongly interacting species that ecologists assume describe ecological systems, and we found regime shifts occurring with no early warning signs, as the general theory predicted.
And your models were based on population. I guess this could apply to fish, algae in a pond, or even humans.
Yes, it certainly could apply to fish or algae or pond and humans and potentially human interactions with diseases and any sort of complex system, even to things like financial markets.
I was interested in your third model, which included three species linked in a food chain. The top predator went extinct without warning. What does that tell us?
Well, that tells us that once you begin to look at the kinds of interactions that ecologists think about, we looked at one, two, or three species, but food webs in natural systems may consist of hundreds of species interacting, some of them quite strongly, that you can find relatively sudden disappearances without these early warning signs that you hope to see in general systems.
Well, given that whole species or ecosystems may depend on prediction of regime changes, especially if those models are used in resource management, say by governments or corporations, how do we know, and I know this is the key question, how do we know which ones can be safely predicted?
I think that we have to go away from looking for general signs and for trying to find very simple explanations to looking at much more careful study of particular systems and using the general ideas in looking at those particular systems, but not thinking that we can find simple signs that carry across to different systems.
Well, this is one of the subtle points of your work. You're saying that each system is so complex that it might as well be considered as unique.
Well, each system is complex, and each system has to be looked at carefully, but there are principles that apply across systems. Sometimes I like to think of this as the idea that we have principles that tell us how to build complex physical structures like bridges or build tall buildings or other complex structures, and the same principles apply, but you would not expect a bridge to behave the same way as a tall building.
All right, I think I understand that. This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking about tipping points with Dr. Alan Hastings from the University of California. You know, Alan, my reaction to your paper is to worry a bit more. If science can't tell us when tipping points are approaching, that means nature is more unstable than we thought. Does this call for more caution when trying to set limits, whether it's for fisheries or for carbon in the atmosphere?
It certainly suggests that there should be more caution and much more careful monitoring of dynamics and much more attention paid to when any potential shifts seem to be occurring.
Well, bear with me for a second here. I know you're a well-respected scientist with a long list of published papers, but when I look over some of your past work, I can almost picture a man who often concludes, "It's hard to say." Except, and correct me and if I'm wrong again, it seems you organize the science, sometimes spending up to $1 million, to prove that some predictions about nature or any complex systems are beyond us for now. And that isn't what funders and the public really want to hear. So the truth is more difficult than we want it to be. Is that partly your point?
Part of the point is that the truth is more difficult, and we have made quite a bit of progress in my own work as well in trying to understand more specific systems. And what we're saying is that just much more care is needed in developing the tools to make the kinds of predictions that we need to be able to make. And in many cases, we have used these ideas to get a better understanding of specific systems, ranging from the dynamics of marine populations, where you can set up simple approaches based on things like marine protected areas that will work in many circumstances.
So you're not advocating that we all need to learn chaos theory. There are some underlying rules that we can go by.
There are underlying rules we can go by, but understanding the complexities of dynamics is going to really help us to understand the natural world around us.
And I wondered whether your work is a little bit subversive, and I say that because science is nothing if it's not based on prediction. We say if such and such is true, then we should find this, some testable state of affairs. But some of your work seems to cut off this last leg. If we can't say when complex systems will react, is science still really possible and worthwhile?
Science is definitely worthwhile, and what we are not saying is that prediction is impossible. What we're saying is that we have to understand the kinds of predictions we are able to make and the time over which we can make the predictions. Just as a weather forecast gives us perhaps accurate predictions over a couple of days, but not over weeks, that gives us one sort of understanding. But on the other hand, we also have the kind of prediction that it's colder in the winter and warmer in the summer, and we can also make that kind of prediction. So we need to understand carefully what the kind of predictions are that we can make and use that as tools in management.
Well, you're reminding me of some comments that Sir James Lovelock made to the BBC. He said that really to just make a straight-up graph of global temperature and then say what's going to happen from that, it could be foolish because there could be sudden jumps that we hadn't expected at all. And I guess that goes pretty well with the work that you've been doing.
Absolutely, that goes well with the work that we've been doing, where we're trying to understand the best ways to make predictions. And in one sense, the prediction that tipping points do exist is itself a very useful piece of information.
Well, I realize my next question is beyond the scope of your paper, but I want to ask if you personally believe that the next few years or decades could experience sudden and disturbing shifts.
Yes, I do worry about that, and there are various signs of potential problems that would cause serious shifts, ranging from changes in ocean circulation, which is potentially very worrying, to other changes even on much smaller scales in terms of cascading effects of species extinctions and changes in species ranges.
And as you said, it looks like there's plenty of room for your theory to grow. I mean, people could use it perhaps in economic markets or predicting things like oil price spikes. Do you see that there are other applications coming along for it?
Definitely. I think that trying to understand how you predict and how you manage complex interacting systems is a field that is just beginning to make real progress.
Well, have we really touched on what you would like to say to the public, or what have we left out? What would you like to add?
I would simply like to add that we definitely should not give up on trying to improve our ability to predict. And also that we've reached a stage where the human influence on the natural system is so great that just sort of trying to leave it alone as much as possible is not going to provide the kinds of safety that we need, and that we're going to have to think seriously about developing much more active management strategies for natural systems.
Well, I suppose that's the saying, if we're going to be gods, we might as well act like gods. We're going to have to do more interactive management, is what you're saying.
Absolutely, and we're doing that in terms of marine areas, and we're going to have to do that more globally, perhaps.
Our guest has been Dr. Alan Hastings, a distinguished professor of environmental science and policy at the University of California, Davis. Dr. Hastings, thanks for a better understanding of the big picture, even if it is harder than we hoped.
Thank you as well. I enjoyed talking with you.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
And I cause nothing but trouble. I understand if you can't.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Oregon Black History Heroes and Legends, a three-day event from September 11th through 13th. The keynote speaker for this 20th anniversary celebration will be Mr. Les Pee-wee Harrison. And other speakers include Imani Muhammad, Mike Crenshaw, Jamo Greenidge, and more. That's Oregon Black History Heroes and Legends, September 11th through 13th, at venues across Portland. Location, speakers, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you do have it tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Health Watch is off, but instead we will hear Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher interview representatives from three local organizations about destigmatizing mental illness and a play called Break the Silence, Break the Stigma. At 11:30, you're going to want to stay tuned for Madness Radio with Dr. Johanna Moncrief. We'll discuss The Myth of the Chemical Cure, a critique of psychiatric drug treatment.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Eye Care, a Southeast Portland optometrist providing eye exams, contact lenses, and medical eye care, as well as eyewear from independent designers. Portland Eye Care is located at 41st and Southeast Division Street in Portland and online at eyepdx.com.
This is Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher at KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. And today we have some special guests that are coming together to host a one-time special event happening in